A spate of racial hate speech surfaced this month as the nation observed the 50th anniversary of the 1965 civil rights marches and the country's long struggles with racial equality. A fraternity song at the University of Oklahoma, a frat email at the University of Maryland, Facebook comments about black men in a Baltimore County neighborhood. Does the wide reporting of these incidents in social and mainstream media and the strong reaction to them suggest a racial progress the incidents themselves would seem to mock? What in the national culture still provides a space for such behavior? Open phone lines in the hour ahead for listener comments, and we'll get some historical perspective from a longtime Baltimore activist and community organizer who just returned from the anniversary commemorations in Selma. First, the news. And welcome back to our second hour. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us on Midday. Troubled, dumbfounded, or totally not surprised, those are some of the reactions to the recent spate of racist hate speech that made headlines. At the University of Oklahoma, a fraternity was shut down after video surfaced of white members of that fraternity chanting a racist song on a bus. In Baltimore County, Facebook comments about shooting black men in the community of Boley's Quarters sparked outrage on social media, including a tweet from the Orioles center fielder, the Baltimore Orioles center fielder Adam Jones. At the University of Maryland, a racist and sexist email allegedly sent by a student fraternity member surfaced, sparking outrage and fierce debates about free speech. This spate of racist hate speech surfaced this month as the nation observes the 50th anniversary of the 1965 civil rights marches and the country's long struggles with racial equality. Does the wide reporting of these incidents in social media and mainstream media and the strong reaction to them suggest racial progress that the incidents themselves would seem to mock? And what in the national culture still provides a space for such behavior, such speech? Big questions that we'll tackle in this hour of the show. We welcome, as always, comments from our listeners at 410-662-8780. It's the first time in Midday we get to react to some of these news stories from the last week to two weeks. Our guest, Heather Harris, a social and media commentator and associate professor of business communications at Stevenson University, I'm happy to say, is back with us on Midday. Heather Harris, nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Ralph Moore is joining us today, longtime Baltimore community organizer, poverty worker, who attended the recent observances in Selma. We get to Ralph's perspective on this in this hour of the show today. Ralph now is program manager at Restoration Gardens, a program in Southern Park Heights for homeless youth. Ralph, nice to have you on the show.
Good to be
just
here.
Restoration Gardens, I hadn't heard of it. Just briefly, I said, it's for homeless youth? Is it a shelter?
It's a housing program. It's in a renovated Talmudic Academy over in Southern Park Heights.
Huh.
The youth are homeless, and homelessness has a lot of different definitions. It's persons who have aged out of foster care. It's persons who have lived with grandma, and grandma suddenly has to go into her own care or has passed away. So it's for all kinds of youth, and it's subsidized. It's part of a larger program that started out as AIRS, that worked with persons who had AIDS, the AIDS Interfaith Residential Services Program, expanded into Empire Homes, working with women with children who needed housing assistance, and now it's expanded to work with youth. So it's part of a growing effort, but anyway, it's been good.
Well, that's your latest project, Ralph. Ralph's been involved in a lot of community projects over the years. Been involved when I first knew you, housing for low income people.
Mm-hmm.
So let me start with you, and then we'll go to Heather on this, because you were just in Selma mm-hmm. for the observances of the civil rights marches there.
Mm-hmm.
Troubled, dumbfounded, totally not surprised. I mean, what's your reaction to these stories? All that came out, I use the word spate. It seems like they all came out within a week of each other.
Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised. I think what we have witnessed most recently since Obama's election is something that was reminiscent of what happened when Ronald Reagan got elected. I don't know if you remember, but Rosalind Carter said he makes us more comfortable with our prejudices. Remember that?
I do remember that comment, yeah.
Well, that seems to be happening to an even greater extreme now, that people are being more comfortable and they're reacting to something. The media is kind of jumping on it. They're catching these things and they're reporting these things. I think that's important. But I think what we have to be careful of is that that doesn't really become what the real issues are. You know, the real issues are that we've had a sad history in this country in terms of race. We went from slavery to segregation to mass incarceration to mass poverty. And those have been concentrations of issues along racial lines. And those things haven't changed. Speaking of Selma, Selma's a very depressed town. You know, you would think it would be running with all kinds of tourist traps,
yeah.
But it's not. Hmm. The town is very run down. There's a lot of poverty. 66% of the children live below the poverty line in Selma. If you go along Jefferson Davis Highway from Montgomery to Selma, you'll see houses on the highway where the roofs are collapsed and all that kind of thing. Down in Selma, they're spending money. Jesse Jackson reported this. They're spending money money for schools in prisons down there. So there are a lot of issues, and those fall along racial lines, but we seem to be focused on who's using the N-word and who's not, and that's important. I'm one who says we should never use that word itself, but always use the N-word. But to me, that's secondary and tertiary to the real issues, that we've got to solve poverty. We've got to end the war on drugs that leads to mass incarceration. We've got to do concrete things to make this the land for liberty and justice for all.
Heather Harris, to you, troubled, dumbfounded, totally not surprised, or some other adjective in your reaction to these stories?
Then I would say all of the above. When I look at the stories in the press, in the media in general, fraternities, universities saying this is not representative of who we are, organizations saying it's not representative of who we are, neighborhoods saying it's not representative of who we are, this is not an African-American problem. This is not an ethnic group's problem, a religious group's problem, a fraternity's problem. This is a national problem with cultural roots. And so I believe in order to address it in any meaningful way, we have to go back and look at what the founding fathers founded. They founded a country that was intended to serve people like them. And I'm talking men, white, heterosexual men of a certain class. It wasn't intended for women. It wasn't intended for African Americans, Native Americans, or any other ethnic group that happened to be here, slaves or indentured servants. And unless we look at what was founded, what the intention was, we will not understand where these incidents arise from. What we are seeing are incidents arising in a cultural space because the dominant cultural space permits what we see.
Someone would hear that, Heather Harris, and say, okay, I'm with you on that, but we fought a civil war. We fought for civil rights. There's a long, dark, disturbing, violent history here to get to where we are today. So frat boys on a bus singing a song about lynching. Wait a minute. We fought wars. Blood was shed over this. We passed laws. Society was supposed to progress and change. Take me back to my founding. We don't have to go all the way back there, do we? But that's what you're saying.
I'm saying if we want to look at the root, we're looking at the fruit.
Yeah.
And we're trying to pick the rotten fruit. But we need to look at what is feeding the root of the tree that's giving birth to these incidents.
Someone else may say, well, no, it's just the father of these boys. It's as immediate as that. The boys on that bus singing that song down at the University of Oklahoma, they heard this from their dads. It's as immediate as that, right?
They said they were taught this.
Right.
And I'm sure they were. Again, the problem is that this stuff is around. We've been a nation that really hasn't wanted to talk about race, right? We've avoided the issue very much. Mm-hmm. And so when these things come out, we want to react very quickly to deal with the individuals who have said the M word, who've sung the ugly songs, who've talked about shooting and killing people and all that. But when there are larger concerns in society that we've never confronted.
No, I'm with Heather what she's saying. I want to go back to her on that point. And actually, this is a point that you made in your opening comments too. But, you know, bring it up to the 21st century for me and help me rehabilitate my thinking about this, that we're supposed to have progressed by now, especially schoolboys, right? Young men who have the opportunity to go to a college and get a decent education and living in a different culture, supposedly a more diverse culture.
The culture is certainly more diverse. We are making progress every single day as it relates to addressing to some extent the challenges that face us with regards to race, gender inequality, class inequality, etc. The young men who say these things, do these things, police officers, people in neighborhoods, when these racial incidents happen, it's about ignorance. It's about a lack of awareness of the humanity in the other person. More often than not, we have been taught, often not formally, because you have the formal culture, and yes, this is America, it's a multicultural society. It's a multicultural society with a dominant culture guiding all those other cultures. And so when we are taught formally about, oh yes, we all get along and this is what we should do, that's the formal discussion. Informally, we still have not seriously and fundamentally grappled with the underlying basic assumptions, as Shine would call it, mm-hmm. that drive the dominant culture to express itself in all these different ways that end up hurting not just the people who are oppressing because of their beliefs in being dominant, but the people who are at the other end of that oppression.
Some of this stuff is handed down, like family heirlooms in terms of these attitudes. You know, they show pictures, and I'm sure you all have seen them, of lynchings where families are bringing their kids and they're having picnics and they're celebrating, but the children are learning about this stuff just from being at that experience. And I'm saying, you know, we're not talking about 100, 150 years ago. We're talking about attitudes that still prevail in our society that are being passed on, where Obama and his family are being referred to by all kinds of ugly and obscene things. This still lives with some people. So we've assumed that because some members of society have moved on, that everybody has, but they haven't. And we haven't made a concerted effort to because we don't talk about it, because we don't do anything about it, to bring about change.
What do you make of the Bully's Quarters story in the context of this discussion we're having with Ralph and Heather Harris? Several comments suggesting shooting unrecognized black men in the Bully's Quarters community in Baltimore County posted on Facebook, on a Facebook group called Bully's Quarters Social Club, with some high-five comments saying, yeah, I agree with that. Only way to resolve this issue, why wait for them to stick first? Get the shotgun. Let's go hunting. Stuff like that. You know, it's like...
That's ugly.
Amazing.
Ugly.
Well, I understand it's social media and almost anything goes in social media. But in part, the reaction to this is interesting, right? First of all, this is a discussion that wouldn't have... We may never have heard about it if it wasn't for social media, right?
Correct.
If it wasn't for Facebook. And then secondly, we might not have heard about it if it wasn't for the other part of social media, which reports on the first part of social media.
Correct.
So this is an interesting phenomenon. I don't mean to laugh, but it's a different world we're living in.
It is. And when I read about the council person in Bully's Quarters, I think her name is Bevins.
Yeah, Kathy Bevins.
Right. She mm-hmm. said that, you know, I understand that racism is prevalent, and I'm just paraphrasing her, but I didn't think it was here. And I think most people think that. Yes, we understand racism is prevalent, but we don't think it exists where we are. We are not necessarily a part of racism. And racism is simply part of the structure of the United States of America. It exists everywhere.
But it's called out more, is it not? Would you agree with that?
It's called out more now because I think of President Obama being in office, and there's some fear associated with that. Right. He came in under the banner of hope and change. But with his presence in the White House, it counters the informal narrative that we have of the United States, which goes back to the cultural roots. And so there is a tension between who is representing the United States and what the United States stands for at a very deep level. And so that tension is probably what's playing out now in the press.
This is dangerous, this conversation on Facebook, among, because you don't know who reads these things, who takes these things to heart. Mm-hmm. The Southern Poverty Law Center says that the number of race crimes over the last few years, especially since Obama's election, have gone up. So it's something to be very nervous and afraid about, that people would take this stuff seriously. Also, since Obama's election, the number of gun purchases and licenses have gone up, too. Yeah. So it's scary. We don't want attitudes and behaviors to lead us to a third civil war. We had the first one with the North versus the South. We had the civil rights movement. And it feels like we're building, at least from some quarters, to a third civil war. And it makes me very, very nervous.
Well, I understand why it would, Ralph, especially when you have somebody posting comments about shooting black men and unrecognized black men in a community in Baltimore County, mostly white community. 410-662-8780. Dan Roderick's here with Ralph Moore and Heather Harris. We'll take a short break and come right back and take some phone calls. We'd like to hear from you on any of these incidents. The one at the University of Maryland, the president at College Park, Wallace Lowe, has some strong things to say about that incident. Then we have also comments from the police commissioner of Baltimore City, which we're going to listen to again and talk about. So feel free to join our conversation here, 410-662-8780. Another story I wanted to throw into the mix here, although these are not racist comments, but it was a comment about racism that got quite a lot of attention. The police commissioner of Baltimore City, Anthony Batts, making a comment to a White House task force on policing about his impressions of Baltimore and racism, saying that he felt like he was in a time machine, that he had stepped back in time to the 50s and 60s. He also appeared a week later on C-SPAN for a Q&A with Brian Lamb. And during this appearance, Commissioner Batts said that Baltimore is still dealing with, quote, black and white racism of the 1960s.
When I came to Baltimore, it's like going back a little bit in time. It's about black and white racism in that city. It's all the things that you dealt with in the 1960s. Communities, although Baltimore, you may have a black community here, you may have a Caucasian community next to it, you may have an Italian community there, you may have a Greek community next to it. So you have a lot of people living in a very short range. What I want to get the community to, and working with my mayor at her direction, is to have those authentic conversations, to bring people to the table where we start having conversations about race, and we start building a new city that is working together to break down those barriers, those neighborhoods, those communities.
What did you think of that, Ralph?
I think it's fascinating. One of the thoughts that occurs to me is that he presides over a police force that's overwhelmingly white, right?
Right. And that's under some pressure and criticism for
an investigation.
Investigation for police misconduct, excessive force.
And that in addition to the race difference, a lot of the police officers don't live in the city and all. So he's dealing with that. And I wonder how much of that is the consequence of what he observed.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also in a town where so many of the corporate positions, the top corporate positions are white versus many African Americans in those positions when the city is something like 66-67% African American. The foundation community is like that. The nonprofit community is like that. So there's a silent
actually
oppression.
The government is not like that.
No.
But that's the only element institutionally where you could say that.
But we were late to the game in that regard because there were many cities in this country that had African American mayors long before Baltimore. We got our first African American elected mayor in 1983 with Kurt Schmoke, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
But there were other cities like Cleveland and Newark mm-hmm. and others that came long, even New York. Long before we
did. The point he's making about neighborhoods, that segregation, the de facto segregation that exists, he makes it sound like Baltimore is unique in this regard, and I don't believe it is. What are you hearing there, Heather?
Right. I think that Baltimore is simply another reflection of, a lot of inner cities, USA. and what he's seeing is probably more acute because he is, in fact, in Baltimore. I am not from Baltimore, but I am taken aback by the different, you know, sections and neighborhoods.
Lack of integration, you mean? In terms of the way we live. Right?
Indeed. Yeah. And even if the neighborhoods are somewhat segregated, you can usually tell how deep that segregation goes by who attends the elementary school in the neighborhood.
That's right.
Right? Because if it is a predominantly white neighborhood, but you have a number of people of African descent and other ethnicities in the neighborhood, and you look at the elementary school, and the elementary school is primarily African American, the people of European descent will usually bus their children out to another school.
Right. Yeah, that's very evident around town here. So to call this, but he's talking about racism, the commissioner, using that term. Is that racism? Is it racism for people to make the choices like that?
On the surface, it might not appear to be racism. It is probably driven by perceptions of racism, of what those parents, those people think will come of their children if they are in the same space as those they perceive as unrecognizable, the other, the deviant, the lacking.
Mm-hmm. One other thing about this, and then we'll take some calls, Ralph. I noticed that the mayor, Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, said that it's not easy to rattle off the names of integrated neighborhoods in Baltimore. And I was struck by that. I think that is true. I mean, we think of a more integrated society we live in 2015 in terms of where we work, where we entertain ourselves, where we go to restaurants, the public transportation, the streets,
sure.
the inner harbor, wherever, right?
Right.
But when we retire to our homes,
right, that's true.
We're living
separately.
Yeah.
And a lot of the concentration of the poverty, you know, neighborhoods in Baltimore and other cities haven't changed much over the last 40 years. The neighborhoods that were poor 40 years ago are still very run down, very poor. And racially speaking, those are the darker neighborhoods. So the folks who've managed to have progress, to be able to move up and do better for themselves, whether white or black, they've tended to go into and live in stable neighborhoods. But there is even segregation between the better white neighborhoods and the better African American neighborhoods.
Right.
You know, there's the Ashburtons and then there's the Roland Parks. There's, you know, whatever. So we still divide ourselves. And Martin Luther King said 11 o'clock on Sunday was the most segregated hour of the week. There's still no integration in churches. People go to different hairdressers and barbershops, et cetera, and so forth. And the schools are you know, the Baltimore City public school system is overwhelmingly African-American, and that whites might go to Poly City, the School for the Arts, maybe Western High School. But there's a certain sense of separateness that exists out there. Do you think
any of this is changing?
Well,
no. I mean,
very slowly.
I think it's a cha-cha. I think it's two steps forward and one step back.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to ask ourselves also, what do we mean by integration? Is it just being present among people who are not like you? Is that enough? Because a lot of the time people think, oh, yes, we are integrated. We have this percentage of these people and this percentage of these people, and we have a ramp for the disabled. And is that enough? It's about really changing now the organizational culture, the institutional culture, to be inclusive so that the people who you are not familiar with, who you don't recognize, that they too have a voice and that they are not existing in the organization and being silenced.
You mean the workplace?
I mean, a
college?
The workplace,
a hospital?
College, any place. Any place that we say is integrated. What does that mean? What does it really mean? Whose voices are heard?
Sharing power?
Right.
Right.
Leadership.
We don't even get to the power conversation.
Right.
Let's take some calls. A couple of our listeners have been holding a while here to get in on this conversation. We welcome them. 410-662-8780. Alfonso, thank you for holding. Go right ahead, please.
Yes. My name's Alfonso. I'm a 52-year-old black male, Baltimore resident. On the topic of the mayor, I agree with what she said. Yes, we do need to take more personal responsibility for our communities, but also we must hold ourselves to a level that we actually conform to what is in society and proper attitudes, actions, behavior, and dress. You know, as long as we portray ourselves as pickaninnies, we will be pickaninnies and be treated as such. And pull your pants up.
Okay,
you know,
Alfonso.
That's that on that.
All right, thank you very much. Who's portraying themselves as that P word? This is a carryover from our conversation in the earlier hour, where we talked about the mayor of Baltimore's call out to black men to take more responsibility, to step up for young black men who may be involved in violence or victims of violence in Baltimore City. Anybody want to respond to Alfonso's comments there?
Well, I don't know where he's getting the P word concept, although I think he was referring to the fact that people walk around with their pants down.
Yeah.
I can't get overly worked up about that. I think it's a statement that people are making by doing that, and I don't think it's the end of the world as we know it.
Let's take another call. Okay, Kyle in Baltimore has been holding to speak with us. Hi, Kyle.
Good afternoon.
Go right ahead, please.
So I'm a Baltimore City school teacher. This is my first year in the city.
Hey.
One thing that struck me, probably my second month in the school system, a lot of my students said, you know, you're the only white person I've ever liked. You're the only white person I've ever trusted. And from a sociology background, at first it was a huge compliment. I'm like, oh my God, it's so amazing. Then I thought about it and I said, you know what, we need to have a conversation. And I spent an entire day and just talked to every student in my class, and they didn't know what racism was. They didn't know the difference between racism and discrimination. So I tried to teach them. I tried to say, listen, racism is an ideology. It's a belief. But discrimination is an action. It's a harmful action against you. And the more I taught them, the more receptive they were of it. And they loved to talk about it. They wanted to know more. They wanted to be able to protect themselves. It was just like eye-opening for them. And so for me, I feel like there needs to be an education, not just black, but on the white side too. What is racism? What is discrimination? You know, the biggest thing for me is being in, I'm in a neighborhood school. I'm one of the only white people these kids see. If they do go to summer camps, there are summer camps available. A lot of them go and they work. If we could get more white men to come out and show them, look, there's nothing to be afraid of. Like, talk, have these open dialogues. Open dialogues, it was so scary to stand in front of a classroom full of black students and have an open dialogue about racism. But I had to do it. I had to.
Well, and you say it was scary. You mean at the beginning, the idea of doing it was scary to you, but then now you're glad you did it.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I was scared, but they were scared too, because they have a big white guy up here talking about racism. And how do you know anything about it? You know, so I had to convince them that I had somewhat of an understanding, but just that once I got the dialogue going, it was extremely rewarding, and I think that needs to happen.
I taught about...
I applaud Kyle for what he did.
Sure. I happen to be African-American. You probably can't tell from your radio, Kyle, but... I taught about prejudice and discrimination in 1974 when I taught high school. I was the first African-American teacher that most of those guys ever had. And we were supposed to teach around...
Excuse me, where was that, Ralph?
This was at Loyola Blakefield.
Wow.
And so we were supposed to teach around 10th graders about conflict, love, and change, those three themes over the course of the year. So I thought I'd teach about racial conflict because I knew that most of them had never had an African-American teacher before. And at that very time, there was conflict in Boston over forced busing. There were people fighting in the streets and people poking flagpoles in other people's eyes, as you'll recall. So it seemed to be very, very fitting. And I think they learned some things. They learned to look at some things differently as a consequence of that. And I still have a lot of contact with some of those guys now. And it's been 40-some years.
What I'm getting from Kyle and you is that actually we don't spend time talking about this. We don't spend enough time integrated as friends and having these conversations.
I agree with Kyle. I am not white, but I've had these conversations in my class. I teach at a traditionally white institution. And when I talk about racism, it can be challenging because sometimes the students can have the perception that I'm coming with an agenda. And it's not an agenda. It's about learning. And so I'm teaching something that may come from the text. Usually I will use film or the text to kind of distance myself from the energy that I feel coming from the students. But the fact of the matter is, when Kyle talked about defining racism, that is so important because racism is systemic. It is institutional. And even though we know there's no such thing as race, because we come from different ethnic groups, we are all human beings. Racism does in fact exist, because we feel the effects of racism depending on, you know, who's in power and how that power is being used by people who are perceived to be othered, unrecognizable, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And so when you have these conversations, students are uncomfortable because it's something that we know exists, but we're not supposed to talk about it. But if we don't talk about it, we can't change it.
Heather Harris, social and media commentator, joining us on Midday from Time to Time, is associate professor of business communications at Stevenson University. Our other guest in Studio A today, Ralph Moore, longtime Baltimore community organizer and activist, now program manager at Restoration Gardens Program for Homeless Youth in Southern Park Heights. Ben in Baltimore, you're up next, joining our conversation. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Sure. Just a comment on racism and segregation. Racism, why it's so hard for kids to define, is because racism is, for me, is a movement. It's almost a revolution. If you look at the cities and how Baltimore City has changed, if you look at the segregation or the white flight from the 1950s, they left because people were from North Carolina and African-Americans mainly, from North Carolina and Richmond were moving. They didn't really agree. They didn't like it. They moved out. That was a movement. Now, if you look back at this time, what's happening is the children of those individuals that had moved out into the county now are coming back into the city. Another movement. Mm-hmm. And if you see the segregation within the cities, that segregation is still present. And the line between the, I guess, the poor and the rich is also becoming really wide, at least in Baltimore City.
Well, yeah, throughout the country. Listen, I appreciate what you're saying, Ben. I just want to add this here because I've been thinking about this. I asked earlier, do you think that's going to change? And I keep thinking and hoping that by, as generations go by, people lighten up. We progress in our thinking. We become more accepting of each other, be more integrated. And one of the things that I think, suspect is happening, or I know is happening in Baltimore City and some other cities, is this people moving back and repopulating after all this, 50 years of white flight. Mm-hmm. There's this sorting out that people have done, that people do. Republicans move to Republican areas, red counties, they're blue counties. Mm-hmm. People sort of live among the like-minded mm-hmm. more than they did in the past. Actually, there's data to show that this has happened in the United States. So my theory is that more progressive thinking people of both races are moving back into the city unhindered or less hindered by the prejudices that their parents and grandparents suffered or had, and that forced them to flee the cities. That's my little theory of trajectory about what could be happening here, and that we could see a better day coming, partly for that reason, within the city limits. As to what goes on outside the city limits, I'm not speaking to that, but I'm talking about in the city itself, that this is a dynamic, I think, that is real.
I hope so. That's a very hopeful scenario that you're
it's
drawing.
It's based on some data.
Well, so. Yeah, and that's fine. I think one of the things that also happens as these dynamics start to take hold is that some long-standing things like the lies and the confusion persist. You know, so it's said about black people that we tend to be stupid, we're lazy, we're more criminal or violent than everybody else, we're more disorderly. So very subconsciously, people accept the mass incarceration because that's, you know, we just happen to be more criminal and we happen to be more locked up. But the experience in Ferguson proved that people were targeted in that city. And the war on drugs has been a mass targeting of people. It's not that people were more criminal. It's that we targeted those neighborhoods and let people who were doing the same thing at the same levels get away, essentially. So we've got to do massive public education to break down the lies and the myths that persist about people, I think.
Heather?
I would have to say that certainly hope is not enough. What is the incentive to change? The ACLU has a report that came out this morning that talks about 109 people killed after having contact with the police. 70% of those people were African American. The majority of them, 79, were shot by police. 31, I think, of the incidents happened in Baltimore City, about 21 in PG County. Those are predominantly places where African Americans exist. What is the incentive for progress? Movement is one thing. People are moving according to their class and where they feel comfortable. But again, that's the key, where they feel comfortable. It's not with other people. It's not integration. If you're moving into the city, for example, especially around the harbor area, it's luxurious. You have a free bus that goes around the city, that area, and picks you up and drops you off. You don't need a car. You can go where you're going. But when you're living in other parts of the city, you're waiting an hour for the bus. I see people waiting and waiting. I've never seen a transportation system like the one here in Baltimore City. There are no words for it. There are no words for it. So what are we hoping for? And unless we have conversations, not just at home, but in the classroom, in the office, in the organizations, and unless we move away from this idea that there are certain races that do certain things, as Ralph said, and we look at human beings as people who have culture, and that culture is taught from one generation to another.
I'm with you, but it sounded like you were saying that the incentive for change is luxurious accoutrements
I'm saying. I'm saying they're moving
better amenities or something.
No.
Not actually human contact and living a different way than your parents did.
No. What I was saying is that they're moving to the city, certain parts of the city, and getting these wonderful benefits.
Right.
I'm saying, but what is the incentive for people to change? They're moving to the city for the benefits. They're not moving to the city to integrate the city in any real way. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I'm not saying that that's the primary motive, mm-hmm. but I'm saying that may be the result. Yeah, because the young professionals, the young progressives are black and they're white and they're Latino. Mm-hmm. Listen, we'll take a break here and come back and talk some more. That's Heather Harris joining us today from Stevenson University, where she's an associate professor of business communications, and Ralph Moore joining us today, longtime Baltimore community organizer, poverty worker who attended the recent observances in Selma, Alabama, and now is program manager at Restoration Gardens in Southern Park Heights. Our conversation about racism continues here. 410-662-8780. Remember, you can post comments on the Dan Rodrick's Facebook page. Just look for that on Facebook. Also, you can tweet us at Midday WYPR or Dan Rodrick's. Let's take some more calls. Linda in Annapolis, we'll go to you next. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I remember when Obama came into office, the Republican Party promised to do everything they could to make him fail. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that was racist in my eyes. And I think that sort of made it open. People looked at that as sort of open season, because since he has been in office, it's been in institutions like the police department, like colleges, where racism is becoming more prevalent. Now, I think we take these are our leaders that we're setting examples for us, and that's what is happening, and that's what I believe. And I think that, oh, God, I believe about this so strongly.
Yeah.
I like to hear your comment about that.
All right, Linda, thank you very much. I remember the congressman, was it State of the Union speech, who
yes.
yelled, "You lie," at the president?
Joe Wilson. Yeah.
Joe Wilson.
Yeah.
You lie. Yeah. Sitting there, you lie, he said to our president. And
I think that goes back to the cultural space.
Yeah.
That cultural space that exists that allows for this type of behavior. It is not just coming out of nowhere. It is condoned informally. And when we hear it, we are surprised because we can't believe that this is really what's happening. We believe in this American dream and this way that America welcomes everyone, and the Statue of Liberty and her flame is about all of us. Is that true?
And yet, you talk about leadership there. Misinformation can come from the leadership. It's coming from those senators and Congress people. But also going back to your earlier reference to what the mayor has been talking about and how black on black problem crime is the big problem. It smacks of blaming the victim to me. I think she may be getting some bad advice from somebody, but that's not the problem. The problem is, I think that we've got to find a way to get people to full employment in Baltimore. The more people have jobs that pay a decent wage and with some benefits, the fewer people that would be involved in the drug trade, I would suggest. Some people are operating in that trade.
I totally agree with you on that.
Right. You know, I know you worked on that.
The road to the middle class around Baltimore used to be, this is what I was told when I got to town. Of course, you lived here. You grew up here. I've been here 36 years or something like that. Was, you know, a good union job, Sparrow's Point. Maybe you didn't finish high school. Right. You got a decent job, pretty good pay. You could find your way to a house and maybe a car by
Through college.
Yeah.
You know, all of that.
That applied to whites and blacks,
right?
Black guys and white guys worked together, took the streetcar down to Sparrow's Point, right?
And then those jobs went away.
And that was that's a seismic change. And that's taken 50 or 60 years for that to settle in here, for people to understand how big that was.
Okay, and then add in mass incarceration so that if you had, you know, two parents trying to have a working class household and trying to hold it together with the kids, you're removing somebody from the household, you're incarcerating them, they can't contribute, so you've got a mom struggling to hold it together generally, mostly women, trying to hold it together, who can't even get to the school to find out what's going on with the kid or to a PTA meeting, because she's probably holding down a couple of jobs, but it's affected family life and it's affected the neighborhoods.
You both started off this hour talking about the history here, which is kind of hard to ignore. Another part of the history is the white flight, you know. From Baltimore and other cities, that's occurred over a 50-year period. In Baltimore, it's remarkable to me that you can almost chart white flight, the population drop in Baltimore, from the time of Brown versus Board of Education in 1954.
And also with the King's assassination, when Martin Luther King's
later
assassination,
on, 68. Yeah, they accelerated it in the 60s. Right. And, you know, fear, prejudice, the highway system built made all that possible.
Right.
That's all systemic and institutional, and that's all part of the history, too.
But also there was black flight.
It's okay.
Yeah, there was black flight, too.
I think we're at a point, you know, where Langston Hughes talked about what happens to a dream deferred. Everybody wants that American dream, black, white, Native American, Latino, Asian. Everyone wants that dream. And, you know, when I think about his poem, we're at the part now where he talks about the festering sore that begins to run. In order to heal that sore, in order to heal racism, we've got to clean the wound of the dominant cultural beliefs that feed what we experience today. That is probably one of the few ways that we can actually make a fundamental shift. There is going to be no incentive because no one wants to leave the comfort zone. I tell my students, don't wait until you have a half Asian child or you have a disabled child or a gay child to get involved in social justice. Social justice is about everyone, and we need to participate in fundamental change right now, today. It's not time for hope. It's time for change.
Not to mention that Ta-Nehisi Coates did this great a piece on the case for reparations. And he says that we will never come to that place of healing until there's actual reparations in this country. I agree with him.
Maggie in Baltimore, our next caller. Thanks for calling Midday, Maggie. Maggie, you there? All right, she's listening to her radio. Let's go to Lawrence out in Tawnytown. Thank you for calling Midday.
Dan, hi. All right. Two fast points. One, you just mentioned that the traditional passage to middle class was via Sparrow. Charles Point.
Well, to use one example,
Is it?
I said to use one example.
As one example, right. And, you know, the reality is that the path towards criminality is poverty and desperation. So, yes, everything we said about curing poverty is a critical component here. The reason why I called, though, was earlier a black gentleman named Alfonso was the one. And I think his point was misinterpreted. It is not, he was not discussing the pants. What he was talking about, the need for working towards assimilation into a different society. Racism is a two-way street. There's no way around the fact that there's a great deal of fault that's systemic within white society. But in order to defeat that racism, there's a need for moving into a society and then proving within that society that we're all the same, that we're all equal.
Oh, we're all equal. I don't know about being all the same. I mean, they used to say this about Italians and Irish and people you had to assimilate into the society, you know, stop eating so much garlic and, you know, start wearing Ralph Lauren clothing. And there's the WASP ideal in America. That's where you want to be, right?
Right.
So, yeah, maybe we all should be equal. I don't know if we're all going to be the same. It's supposed to be the great melting pot.
Well, there is no melting point. There is no salad, right? Yeah. There's a dominant culture and everyone else is trying to so-called assimilate into that dominant culture. If we want fundamental change, we're going to have to look for ways to redefine assimilation so that it includes aspects of the other cultures and not just one culture. When we think about, you know, cultural integration, we think about, oh, you know what, I had Ethiopian food last night, or I went to see a flamenco dancer. Oh, that was so wonderful. Did you see the sari the woman was wearing? That's just the surface. We need to understand each other at the deep level of traditions, beliefs, and values. And we're not having those conversations. We are afraid to have those conversations. We need to change the books that the students learn from. We need to provide all students with an excellent education so that they can then make decisions that make sense, as opposed to having the people who currently rule have their children make decisions for everybody else and have the cycle continue.
I had a college professor years ago who said that you know, there's this movement toward the blandification of America. And that's what this guy sounds like.
I've heard it called the homogenization.
Everybody becomes the same. The image he had was all these individually wrapped slices of Velveeta cheese and all. We don't really need to be like that. I appreciate the differences. I enjoy tasting other people's foods, learning other people's stories, cultures, all that kind of thing. I think it enriches me, and I like to tell mine. And I like being who I am and people having friends who, you know, accept you for who you are, and you're different from them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we might have misinterpreted Alfonso's
remarks. Some white people look at young men with the droopy pants and say, yeah, that's cool, you think you're supposed to look like that, but that's not going to get you anywhere in society. In this particular society,
right,
and they want to see them do better.
And I think that is their hope, but it's bigger than their pants and the pants drooping down, and that's what I'm saying. We have a great tendency to focus in on the little things when there are larger issues and larger concerns that we need to be looking at.
We've got time for one more quick call, Pat in Baltimore. Go right ahead, please be brief, Pat.
Hi, yes, I wondered if you heard of the book. The Book of Meme Law, which covers why this is happening, and it covers why it's happened, and how it resurges every time we think we have a breakthrough, how it recycles, and why it again and again and again. I wondered if you've heard of that book, and it's available out there. I just read it, and it gave me a lot of insight into what happens in each of the organizations I belong to. And
what was the title again, Pat? The Meme?
The Book of Meme Law.
Of Meme Law.
Okay, Book of Meme Law. I've heard a little bit about this meme theory. In fact, I can't remember all the shows we did. I think we did a show on this like 2 or 3 years ago. But thank you for mentioning that. That is a good question. You know, it's recycled and it comes up in different forms, but actually very much the same sometimes, too, which is troubling.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad we had this conversation. I'm glad we talked about this. Probably should do this more often.
Yes.
Thank you, Ralph Moore.
You're welcome.
Nice to have on the show, and good luck with your new job at Restoration Gardens in Southern Park Heights. And Heather Harris, thank you very much for being here. Heather Harris,
you're welcome,
Associate Professor of Business Communications at Stevenson University, who joins us from time to time for social criticism. Media commentary. Well, thank you everybody for tuning in today. We didn't solve all the problems of the world. We didn't settle anything here, except it was good to have this conversation. It's a very challenging topic, and I'm glad we had it. We'll pick this up again another day on Midday. On behalf of our staff, have a great afternoon. We'll see you again tomorrow.